Welcome to The Procurement Show.
Hello and welcome to The Procurement Show, the show that tackles the topics we all need to think about and sets out to explore the more interesting bits of procurement. I'm Jonathan O'Brien.
And I'm Paul Philpott. And for the purposes of this specific episode, I've spent the last 24 hours rummaging through Jonathan's drawers looking for evidence.
More on that in a moment. Because this week we're talking negotiation and considering how we can improve our capability by learning from what the police do when interviewing suspects and criminals. It's not the form of negotiation we know in procurement, but it is another form of negotiation around establishing the truth and finding ways to compel people to do something or give up something.
The Procurement Show is brought to you by Positive Purchasing and Proclius, the Strategic Procurement Toolkit, Academy and AI-powered workflow.
And to help us do this, we're joined by a former detective from the UK Police who's worked on some very high-profile cases here in the UK and has vast experience of interviewing victims and suspects in the pursuit of justice. Please welcome to The Procurement Show, Detective Dave.
Is that your real name, Dave?
Well, Dave is, yes. Dave.
Well, for I got to say...
I'm not going to tell the whole world who I am.
No.
No, true.
Because we've got to be a little careful here. Because security reasons, we can only call you Dave. Also, we can't refer to any specific cases that you've been involved in.
Right.
Because you have got...
you.
Okay. Well,
so you can volunteer, but we can't probe.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that's fair enough.
We'll see how it goes.
Okay.
So we thought it'd be really interesting because I think we can learn a lot from you in terms of your experience of interviewing offenders and victims as well. But I thought I'm going to go straight in with this one. So how can you tell when somebody is either not telling you everything or just plain lying?
I suppose if you look at the TV programs and all that we watch, whether it's the police dramas or whether it's documentaries, you sit there thinking, we're sitting there sweating, he must be lying. Mm. Well, he might not be lying. He might just be really unfamiliar to the circumstances. The investigation isn't concluded. You don't know whether he's innocent or not, or guilty or not. And he could be really uncomfortable with the process. But at the same time, he could be lying. You look at body language, you look at where they're looking, what they're saying, are they keeping direct eye contact? Are they looking down a certain way when they're answering questions? And it's about building that rapport with them, which we'll talk about as we go through this, from the very beginning to the end, and taking them on that journey and recognizing. And sometimes you can just see their shoulders slump and they just go, oh, yeah, okay, I did it.
And then that means when they do that, they like let go, is that?
Yeah. Okay. And sometimes you can see that, and sometimes you have to give them a break. And it is a difficult journey, especially I specialized in interviewing sex offenders. Mm-hmm. And it can be a difficult journey for them.
Yeah.
You know, and you've got to take them on that journey and almost support them on that journey as you go along and hopefully reach a conclusion where, I mean, you've talked about justice in your introduction there, where you get some justice for victims or whatever it might be.
And you mentioned the eyes there. I just want to dive into that. So is this the kind of eyes go up to their right, they're lying, eyes go to their left, they're telling the truth, or is it not always like that?
Sometimes it is. I did what used to be the CEOP master's course in interviewing child sex offenders. And they talk to you about, well, if their eyes go this way, they're lying, or they're telling the truth, it goes the other way. And some people, you've got to bear in mind things like that there. But actually, when it comes down to it, it's a gut feeling sometimes, isn't it? And it just comes down to experience.
You whether you actually had formal training in this or whether you instinctively know, you're just one of those people who instinctively knows what they're being told, whether it's true or wrong.
I think you develop that as a police officer, you develop that as you go along. And yeah, you can do training. So you do interview skills course, advanced interview course. I've gone off, like I said, and done various courses with a chap called Professor Joe Sullivan, who's still around, still presenting training and all the rest of it. And that's around specialist training and interviewing sex offenders, advanced training. So you feel confident enough in interviewing people for murder and stuff like that. But it is really hands-on experience. Yeah, it's about how you plan things and knowing how to plan, and comes with years of training and experience.
When I come back into the country from my various trips and I get dragged aside by customs and excise.
Is that regularly for you?
Is that when they sort of stop you and flick the glove as they put on your hand?
Exactly,
I've had that.
Well, not that, but the flicking.
I actually have a t-shirt that says, get your glove ready. You get asked a string of questions, and then it sometimes feels you're being asked the same set of questions again.
I've had that too.
And then the same questions again. Yeah, enough about your marriage. The same questions again, but in a slightly different way.
Yeah.
Is that a tactic?
It is, yes, because you're giving an account, and if it's truthful, you'll be able to repeat that same account. But if you're not telling the truth, and if they probe it and repeatedly probe it, you're going to let slip with something. And also your response, you mentioned there about how do you know someone's lying and all the rest of it? But your response when customs are asking you questions. If you've got something to hide, if you've got a few hundred pounds worth of cannabis stuffed in your suitcase when you're coming back from your holiday, you're thinking, oh, and you're going to start to feel uncomfortable. So it's just them gently probing your account to them make their experience. Is he lying or is it truthful? Mm. Is he giving us a different account as we go on? But also, when you're gaining someone's account, you want to get that recall.
Mm-hmm.
And they might think, well, actually, we are a bit uncomfortable with this one. We're going to come back and ask him some more questions and go from there.
Okay, so it's not that they're just very forgetful.
There's a reason behind it.
I can't imagine it's black and white either, because earlier on we were talking about sweating in certain situations. I sweat in most situations. It's just my default position, especially when you're in a studio like this, if you're under lights. And also if somebody asks you something, a question that's opinion-based or recall-based, and they ask it to you several times, I don't always give the same answer, but it doesn't mean I'm trying to hide something.
And if they're going to apply pressure to you at that time, like if I was to sit here chatting to Jonathan, I could sit and slowly move a bit closer to him and move a bit closer to him. He's not using his link, so he will start to feel a little bit uncomfortable, won't he? And I'll just maybe change the tone of my voice. And it's just, when you're a police officer interviewing people, it's not like you see in the movies. You can't shout at them. You can't apply lots of pressure through that way. You can't change the tone of your voice. You can't add pressure by moving in.
Mm-hmm.
And then that moment, oh, okay, yeah, fair cop, it was me.
Yeah.
Not that that's ever happened.
Yeah. And some of them, as you say, are just going to naturally sweat. So Prince Andrew would be great in an interrogation, right?
Yes, of course, yes.
He doesn't sweat.
Let's talk about facts and data, or evidence, I think is what you'd call it. Because in procurement, we bluff a bit. You know, we don't call it bluffing. We call it, I mean, it's lying, but we call it bluffing because it sounds like we're good people then. If you're not certain of your position, but the perpetrator doesn't know that, can you bluff? You know, if you don't have the evidence, you don't have the facts and data.
You've got to act with integrity throughout the whole process.
Right.
You can't. I was saying that there have been occasions when I've walked into an interview and I've got a stack of papers with me and I've put those papers down on the desk. Now, I haven't said what they're for, but the person sitting on the other side of the desk might come to the conclusion that that's all the evidence that's stacked up against them.
Yeah.
And you start, well, I'm going to start going through this evidence now, and then you take the statement off the top.
Yeah.
But you can't. There's a whole process set up around solicitors and all the rest of it where you give disclosure. So when someone's arrested, they're entitled to know what they're arrested for.
Yeah.
You give disclosure to their solicitor. Now, you can just say what they're arrested for and leave it at that, or you can tell them everything. So somewhere in between, depending on what you're dealing with, or you can do a thing called phased disclosure. But one thing you can't do is lie, and you can't bluff it. You can't just wing it, because you're going to end up sitting there going, oh, well, I've got nothing to say, really, have I? You know, I just thought I've brought you in a wing and a prayer, and it's just not going to work. And you're going to sit there with egg in your face, and it could be very embarrassing.
Yeah, we could learn a lot from that in the procurement world.
I was just going to say, that's really interesting. So the example you gave about walking into a room with a pile of papers and the other party will think it's evidence. You could walk into a quotation review thing with quote one, quote two, quote three written on a pile of papers, and they would immediately assume that you're going to be given comparison.
And now it's time for this week's fun fact.
Starbucks buys over 93 million gallons of milk per year, the equivalent of 155 Olympic-sized swimming pools, or 55,000 cows operating at maximum output each year.
So now you know.
Oh, I thought you were going to say, that's very moving, but you didn't.
No.
Okay.
Go on, I should have tried the other one.
Yes. That's quite funny.
The fun fact. Contact us by email, hello@theprocurementshow.com, or connect with us on LinkedIn. Search for The Procurement Show. The Procurement Show is brought to you by Positive Purchasing and Capella, the guided category strategy creator powered by AI and 5i.
And there was the other example you gave with regards to letting a bit of knowledge share earlier on. What are the parallels?
It's interesting because in the world of procurement, people lie much more. And, you know, I've spent 20 years...
It's shocking, isn't it?
Well, I know nothing about procurement, but surely lies.
Especially in government. That's a whole other story. But, I mean, I spent 20 years training people how to do negotiation. And some of the tactics, which I don't really think work, but what people think is negotiation, is they'll have the pad, they'll have the three quotes, they'll write things on so the other people can read upside down and do all that sort of stuff. Create the bluff that, yeah, we've got better offers on the table, and deliberately make the other party feel uncomfortable in some way. All really quite crude tricks, but that is what people do. And I don't think that works, by the way. I'm really encouraged to hear you say, you know, when the police are interviewing somebody, you can't lie, you've got to act with integrity. Actually, in my experience in the procurement world, it's the people that negotiate with integrity that get the furthest results in the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's always that old adage, don't ask the question you don't know the answer to. But sometimes you might have to do that in order to explore an area when you're trying to find out more information about what's happened. But at the same time, there is a chance, look, and I've done it where I've said, look, I don't know what's on your phone. We're going to forensically examine your phone. What are we going to find on your phone when we forensically examine it? And maybe you're not bluffing, but what's the chance of there being something on there? Mm. And it just makes them think, you don't know what the answer is. You're not bluffing, but you're giving them something to think about.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm thinking about somebody in a procurement interview reading upside down. I mean, stringing them up by their feet's a bit extreme, but you know.
It is. That happens too. I've seen that.
Yeah. But I'd like to explore the concept of body language a bit further. Are there any specific examples that you can give us that you look for?
I think I mentioned early on about taking them on a journey. Mm. And certainly you want to meet the person. And as you're carrying out an investigation, you might identify a suspect and you're going to plan your approach to that suspect. You're going to work out how you're going to do it, who's best to approach that subject. And you look at what their history might be, who they are, what they've done, and you plan that approach. You then start building that rapport with them. If you can avoid kicking their door in and dragging them out by the collar of their shirt, then all the better, because you want to sit down and talk to them. And then from that very start, you're looking for body language. You're looking, thinking, yeah, he's done it or she's done it.
Yeah,
they're dejected, they're down. Yeah, they might start to confess things there and then. And it's about then bringing them on that journey down into custody, into an interview room, through that process. You're listening to me now to encourage me to talk. You're nodding your head.
I am.
And you're leaning forward, you're holding your chin, you're going, yeah. Well, that's to encourage me to talk, but I'm reading that as really positive. And does he obviously likes what I'm saying?
We do it deliberately.
Yeah. And we're doing the same thing. And you're going to do it when you go off for negotiations.
It's all a fraud, Jonathan.
He's rumbled us. Quick.
Our life is just
let's run. Sorry, I didn't mean to embarrass you. Sorry.
No. But you have to do it as
the police are doing the same thing. They're reading body language. We're going to copy what they're doing to show that we're interested. You know, you move a bit, I'm going to move a bit.
Yeah.
And it just shows that you're interested. And it's not just what they're saying, it's how they're saying it.
So the mirroring of body language is a very interesting.
There's a term for that.
Mirroring.
No.
That's the term.
No. Postural echo.
I think you can get cream. It'll clear it up in no time.
Yeah, quite.
Yeah, there's all sorts of science around it. And there'd be people better qualified than me to speak about this to you. But it is around just reading the room, reading what that person's doing and responding to it.
And if you want somebody to do something, because I guess a lot of this is about you're taking people on that journey and you're trying to get them to do something they don't want to do, either confess or give up information, grass somebody up.
It might be difficult for them as well, because I talked about I specialize in interviewing sex offenders. Well, it might be that they've abused a child. It might be they're looking at indecent images of children, images of child abuse on the internet and stuff like that. That's going to be really difficult for them to talk about, isn't it? You know, up until 5 minutes ago when you knock on their door, you're a complete stranger. Mm-hmm. You know, in that initial plan of how you respond, what you speak to them, you've got to put them in a position where they feel comfortable enough to talk to you.
Mm.
And if you sit there and go, that's absolutely, I was going to swear there, that's absolutely bloody disgusting.
Yeah.
And they're going to go, they're going to shut down, aren't they? Yeah. And you're not going to get what you need.
Yeah. Are there any particular levers that you do to get that rapport going? Is there anything particularly you do there?
I think all the things we talked about, it's about that rapport. It's about not showing shock when they're saying something and creating that environment. It's like we've come in here today and I've not sat in a studio before with cameras on and all the rest of it. And it can be quite intimidating. A police interview room can be intimidating. And you're going to put them in a position where they're going to feel uncomfortable. You're going to move their chair a little bit away from the table, maybe. You're going to move yourself around. If they've got a solicitor, you'll try and keep the distance between him and his solicitor so that they feel a little bit on their own.
Yeah.
Those little things, letting them know that we're out searching your home as we speak. Mm. So just applying that little bits of pressure to let them know, actually, you're doing a professional job and we're going to continue down this until we find the answer type thing.
What about trading things? So exchange of information, or I'll let you know but I've got this insight if you tell me about this. Because you use that in procurement quite a lot, don't
something
you?
For something. Yeah,
something
for
something else. Yeah. Do you use that technique?
You're not meant to. Like I said, it is about integrity all the way through the process, isn't it? But you may well get a solicitor who comes to you and says, look, my client wants to admit this, but are they eligible for a caution? So the first rung on the ladder of the criminal justice system. And you might go back and say, yeah, look, I've spoken to a supervisor, I've spoken to a decision maker, and yeah, they can have that caution. That's about as far as it goes. But then you go up to another level, maybe, where you've got what we used to call taking things into consideration, TICs, where, look, yeah, my client's willing to cough to five burglaries if you take so many into consideration and charge. I suppose the answer is it's not meant to happen, but it does happen in reality. You're dealing with informants. Years ago, I haven't dealt with informants for years, but years ago when you deal with informants, they might say, look, this has happened. You go and speak to someone. I want a favourable letter to the judge, and you would deliver a sealed envelope to the judge who would read what's happened and how this person might be charged with this offence today, but they have assisted in something else. So we're giving you that bit of information about something more serious. They're dealt with more leniently. And that does happen. Well, certainly used to happen a few years since I retired from the police.
We'll be right back in just a moment.
Negotiating is a bit like building muscle. Without the muscle, you won't get the results. But the more you train, the stronger you get. And before you know it, you'll be the strongest. Build your negotiation muscle today. Train your team in Red Sheet Negotiation and watch them win.
Yes.
Visit Red Sheet Negotiation and find out how the top performing companies negotiate.
The Procurement Show with Jonathan O'Brien.
So what do you do if you don't get any movement? A situation where they seem to hold all the power and they know they hold all the power. How do you handle that?
Well, people will. They don't have to talk to you in an interview. And if they've got a solicitor there as well, it makes it even more so. They will necessarily say nothing. And then you think, but you've got to continue through that process. You've got to ply on through. So if you've planned it right, so for example, if you know something has happened and they might give you a prepared statement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they'll give you a piece of paper drafted up by the, that's me ruffling paper, sorry.
That's all right.
Drafted up, they'll read it out and there's my prepared statement. I'm saying nothing else. Well, you're still going to have to pick that through. So they might talk about, well, I wasn't there. I was doing this. I was at home watching TV. I went to the pub and I came home again. So you'll box that off. You'll talk about what they did at home, who was there, what they were watching on TV, what night was it, or as much detail as possible. Okay, you went to the pub, and they'll continue to say no, but you'll ask them those questions. And that applies, you've got to go through that process. So they'll say nothing, and some people will have a hatred for the police, and that'll come with them into an interview room, and they'll look at you with great disgust. And do you know that sort of, I don't want to insult people, do you know that sort of, it's superior, unjustified, look down at you, you know?
Yeah.
What do they know? Coppers. And they'll sit with their arms folded and say nothing. You're still going to have to answer the questions. You're going to have to go through the evidence. You're going to have to put it to them and try and get them to respond. And sometimes, though, a prepared statement that they present or a one-liner that they let slip because you've doggedly kept going is enough, because they're answering questions under caution.
Yeah.
They will rely on court what they're saying or not saying. And if they choose to say nothing or just give one line, then you can explore that before you go to court. Gather your evidence. And it may be they turn around and say something different in court. Well, why did you not say that when you were in the police? You had the opportunity. Mm-hmm. That's completely different from what you said. And then the jury think, hang on a minute, which one's the truth?
Yeah. This is so like negotiations with suppliers and the idea of they treat you with contempt and they're looking down on you. And
quickly on my notes here, scribbled that, you know, you've got that four quadrants power dynamics graph, whether you can apply that to this. Because you've got something that I want, I've got something that you want, or somebody else is holding all the cards. It could be them, it could be you.
Yeah.
It's quite an interesting thought.
And it is, and it's something that we do, in fact. So you're comparing the how difficult is the market with how much do we spend. And actually, if you're spending a lot of money and the market's not difficult, we've got great leverage there. So, you know, we have the power, but there are situations where the market's difficult. We need that supplier. They know we need it. We're not spending a heck of a lot of money with them, perhaps. And in that situation, they have all the power. So in negotiation terms, it's about, you know, how do we build that rapport that you talked about? How do we build that relationship? Because they could just decide, you know what, we don't need this anymore. And that's where there's risk there. So exactly what you're suggesting, using the portfolio analysis matrix, Krawczyk matrix, is how we can determine our negotiation response. And it's really interesting to hear the parallels from the police service.
We used to look for a thing called fogging. Mm-hmm. Where you're interviewing someone and they would go off on a tangent and talk about absolute rubbish or something that's not linked to it in order to try and distract you, and you lose track of what's going on over here. And if you're negotiating, you want to try and keep that person on track, don't you, as to where you want them to go in order for you to get your deal with them. And you just got to give them enough rope sometimes and let them talk and then pull them back in again to what's really important and what you're talking about, what you're trying to deal.
David, I don't suppose you ever go backwards in an interview, do you? You've mentioned integrity a lot, so it probably goes against integrity.
I thought you meant backwards as in explore an account backwards there sometimes.
Well, actually, yeah, apply it.
You wouldn't
go
back on what you said, so you can't go back and deny that something has happened. So if you're interviewing someone, it's a bit like here today, it's all recorded.
Yeah.
And it's gone from little tapes you plot in to pressing a button and cameras and sound as well. So you can't.
And that applies to you as well. You couldn't try and use a tactic to get them in the corner of a conversation and force them. That's that bit underhanded. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Not really, no.
No. He's a good one, isn't he?
Yeah. Well, no, because it all gets thrown out because you're not just thinking what's happening in that room. From the very start of the investigation, you need to think, well, is this going to go to court? And they will examine everything because that's what barristers get paid for,
isn't it? Of course, yeah.
In forensic detail. And the defence barrister, if there's an opportunity to have something thrown out, that's crucial. If you mess up the interview because you've done something underhand, it gets lost.
Yeah.
You don't have it. You can't rely on it in court. And all of a sudden, you're in a bad position and someone could get away with murder.
So can you be their friend? If we watch all the movies, you've got the good cop, bad cop routine. And does that still work? Is it a real thing? I know you've talked about building rapport, but is there that step where you become their friend and then somebody comes in and they're the bad cop to try and shake it up a bit?
I think friend is a strong word, possibly. I talked about rapport.
Yeah.
And I think it's important you build that rapport and build that relationship with them. And you wouldn't necessarily say they're your friend. I mentioned about planning, and it could be when you sit down and plan, you're going, well, actually, I'll do the introduction. I'll gain the first account and we'll explore that. But you've always got to be ready for the other person to jump in. And it might be that you've given the signal in an interview that you need a break. You want to think about what you're doing. So the other person will step in and ask some questions. Or it could be that the other person's waiting and they're going to do the challenge because you've built the relationship. You're exploring their accounts. And then the other person you're interviewing with will come in and do a challenge phase where you're being a lot firmer with them and pushing your point.
That's good cop, bad cop.
Yeah, you'd never actually, I suppose you would call it that, but that's what you might perceive as good cop, bad cop.
Or you've got roles, you've got specific roles. Yeah. You know when you watch dramas and they get the person in, they give them an initial interview, and they go out and they get some more evidence, and they get them back in for an interview again, and they go out and get some, they kind of tend to go around in circles somewhat. Is that just what we see on television for dramatic effect because they have to make a series out of something? Or does that also happen?
No, it does happen. So you might get someone in and interview them. Initially, they've got 24 hours. That's why they call it 24 hours in police custody or something, that TV program, don't they?
Yeah.
You've got an initial 24 hours. You can interview them and leave them in their cell, go off, explore what they've said, and come back and interview them again. You can ask for an extension and go to the magistrate's court, get some more time. The inspector can give you more time. You can go to the magistrate's court and get more time because you need to interview them more. But you've got to be seen to be doing stuff. You just can't leave them sitting in there like they did in the 70s, nothing happening, not giving him any food. Well, he'll get hungry, he'll want to speak to us. That just doesn't happen. But you do have like murder or more serious offences where the interview is monitored. So it's recorded, like we're recorded here today and you've got a chap sitting there and behind the glass doing all the technical stuff. Well, actually, somewhere else in the police building, the interview will be monitored by a team and maybe an interview advisor who's helping you build that plan for the interview and other people. And it could be you've got someone leading an investigation who's going, right, oh, he said this, right, send an officer around that address now, get your detective to go and ask questions, come back. And then the next time you go and interview them, you've got more stuff to put them and say, well, actually, do you remember that last interview you said you spent the night at this address? We've been there. That's just not true. So it depends on the urgency. But also, like I said earlier on, sometimes just that one line they say is the important line. Bail them out, they can come back, and you can put the evidence to them then. So it does happen that way.
And now it's time for this week's Ask Jonathan.
And today's Ask Jonathan comes from Liam Gallagher. Now, I don't think it's that particular.
Is that what he's doing now? Writing to you.
Yes, yes.
God, that imagine
that. Most interesting thing he's probably ever done, if it is. Who writes, can AI really take over from humans to negotiate? And what happens when the AI is negotiating with another AI.
Well, this is really interesting. I think we're going to do a podcast on this because there's a lot of stuff out there about AI doing your negotiation for you.
And in fact, that first AI a while ago, that did really well.
Yeah, absolutely. And we built a tool, our Ruby guided negotiation plan creator has AI in it, and you can negotiate with it. When we put it live, because it's drawing on all our experience of negotiation, it blew us away because we started negotiating with it and it was better trained than we thought it would be. And we put it in front of some CPOs and got them to try it. And it was astonishing how good it was. So that's AI drawing on what it's learned from to do a negotiation with you. And you know, there's a couple of other people out there doing it as well. It's still early days technology though. And what's happening now is as this is emerging, you've got suppliers that are saying, well, we're going to negotiate with you. Now, in terms of AI doing the negotiation, at the moment, it's only happening at the level of complex, undifferentiated tail spend. Any other sort of strategic, complex stuff, there's got to be a human in the loop. So what I think is going to happen is AI-powered negotiation will just become part of your ERP system. It's just how you do electronic commerce. There'll be a negotiation bot in there that does something. But of course, that negotiation bot is going to be negotiating with the supplier's negotiating bot, and they're all going to be drawing on the same things. So it's just going to bring it down to the natural common denominator. It'll just be part of the tech that we use. So it's not going to take over from humans. It's going to make some of the automatic, low complexity stuff routine. It'll just be part of how that stuff happens. The real stuff, the strategic stuff, the stuff that's going to give us a competitive advantage, that's the stuff where the human is going to be in the loop for a long time, because that's where the advantage will come from.
I've got to add, what scares me is the potential speed of it all, though.
Because the speed is scary.
At the moment, when we interface and interact with AI, we are listening to an output or reading an output. It's being given to us at the speed of human. But if you've got AI onto AI, the speed is lightning fast. And we know when in the stock market, once automation came into play, they actually had to regulate the buying and selling of stocks and shares, etc., in order to avoid crashes and people having an unfair advantage. Do you think that will come in this arena?
I think it could do, but I think the scary thing is we just don't know. Because you play that out into this arena and then you have a situation where everything's automated with AI driven at the center on both sides. It's almost a bit like unleashing the dragon. We don't quite know what's going to happen. And it may be that it does something unpredictable. But that's the exciting bit.
It is exciting. Really good question, Liam. In fact, such a good question, we might do an entire episode on it. If you want to ask Jonathan a question, here's how to get in touch.
Ask Jonathan. Email your question to jonathan@theprocurementshow.com. You might be part of the next show. The Procurement Show is brought to you by Positive Purchasing and Ruby, your AI negotiation co-pilot.
So it is this iterative process where you're interviewing and then gathering evidence and then you're coming back and testing it some more. And so
definitely.
So that continual evidence gathering, facts and data gathering along the way is essential.
You've got to do that and you've got to test it at every stage as well, because it could be that the person you're interviewing is innocent.
Yeah.
So you have to test that evidence. You've got to reach and think about that burden of proof beyond all reasonable doubt in the case of the police. I arrested a chap. He was very cocky and he comes into custody and he doesn't want a solicitor, get him interviewed. Yeah. But we start chatting to him and he says, look, it wasn't me. Look, I've done many things wrong. He says, that wasn't me. And I says, but I'll tell you who it might be. It might be my cousin.
Mm.
There were some things how he described his cousin and we thought, hang on a minute. And he was innocent.
Yeah. Okay.
And it was his cousin who'd been downloading stuff on the internet that he shouldn't have been and all the rest of it. And seeing his cousin was a scoutmaster, that wasn't too good.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier the then they say something and the thing that they say is the thing that nails them. And I just want to talk about what people say. Are you listening to the words, the sort of language that they use, and listening to what is unsaid in what people say?
People will sit there and sometimes, I wouldn't say a smile comes across their face, but if they're thinking about something, you'll see that they're enjoying that thought process. So they'll try and minimize what they're saying. So if we're talking about something they've viewed on the internet, and they'll start thinking about it in their head, And you'll almost sometimes see them enjoying that thought process.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're trying to explore that. Well, what is it that you saw nice about that? What is it that turned you on about that? What was it that you found attractive about that image or something that happened? And you can almost see them reliving some things in their head and getting pleasure from that thought process.
Mm.
And yeah, it's interesting. Yeah.
And it's a really difficult thing to talk about, but really interesting to hear the parallels with what you're doing in a real critical situation that's making a difference to society and the world we live in. But it's the same process when we talk about negotiation, we bring it back into a business scenario. It is the same process. So it's great to learn about some of these things.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's funny because your answers are equally interesting and disturbing in same proportions.
You might, and I talk about phase disclosure and stuff like that, so you might tell the solicitor a bit and move on. Just going to be careful what I say here.
Yeah.
There was a job where we'd decided to put covert cameras into a room to find out what was happening in that room. Now, we then witness something happen, arrest the person, bring him into custody.
Mm-hmm.
We don't tell the solicitor that we've had covert cameras and caught them doing something in that room, because we want the person to talk to us and tell us what's going on, because there's a whole set of circumstances leading up to that.
Mm-hmm.
So we're saying, tell us what happened in this occasion and all the rest. And we're very careful to say.
Yeah.
So we were getting them to free recall and tell us about what was happening over that period of time. And they were almost enjoying the attention of trying to help us as to find out exactly what happened to their child. And then when we moved on to that challenge phase that we talked about, and you say, well, actually, I want to show you some evidence now. I want to show you a video clip.
Hmm.
And you turn around and play the laptop and they see what's happening and you're describing what's going on. And the brown stuff hits the fan and the solicitor's not happy. But you've got the evidence about everything else up to that point, haven't you? And now you think, well, I'm going to introduce this new evidence and really go for a hard challenge.
Yeah. You said earlier, it's about asking a question you already know the answer to.
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes it might be, like I said, it's we've examined your phone already. It's about you've gathered that evidence.
Yeah.
It's like you say, in your case, it's data.
Yeah.
In the police's case, it's evidence, it's information. That gives you the power.
It's been really good that you've shared some of the difficult things that you've worked on. And thank you for everything you've done to help make the world a better place.
Well, I thought I was going to bore you to death. I interviewed a woman for murder once. And as you go through this process, and we went back in three times to interview her, she goes to court and we're sitting in court and I'm sitting there and you do this role play thing almost with what was a KC then, a barrister, or QC then, sorry, the King now, isn't it? QC and the barrister. And you go through this where you relive the interview. I do my bit, the barrister does the suspect's bit, and you're sitting there and it was a murder trial. So interesting.
Mm.
And I nodded towards the jury and there was someone in the jury who'd fallen asleep while I was talking.
Well, that happens sometimes on this show, actually,
yeah, it does,
I'm honest.
Yeah.
But how do you put this stuff away in your head?
Sometimes police officers get counselling and therapy, and sometimes they can ask for it and ask for that support. And it's really important it's there because police officers go to the most horrendous things.
Mm-hmm.
And within an hour, they've moved on to something else that could be equally as horrendous. They've gone from someone in a car accident who's died. Within a couple of hours, an hour, they could be dealing with something else. And it's about providing support. So it is important. But I hate to say, I'm a bit old-fashioned. I dealt with it through a pint down the pub and a chat with mates and a bit of dark black humour that deals with it. And you box things up. You put it behind you. I can still think of things that I've seen and done over the years. And you think, yeah, it's upsetting. I'm going to put that back in the box and slip it there and leave it there. And occasionally it's explored.
Yeah. Jonathan's going to do the same with his career.
Yeah, put it in a box. I think it's already in a box in the bottom of the wardrobe, actually.
Yes, in the British archives.
Thanks for that.
I guess one of the ways that you will relax is at home with a good takeaway.
Yeah.
Every person that we interview always wonders, where am I going with this?
Including me on every episode of this show.
That's right. What are your three takeaways?
Planning.
Mm-hmm.
It's the old thing. You know, the five P's, prior planning prevents poor performance.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah.
Reviewing, constant reviewing.
Yeah.
Like we talk about it, it's about the integrity of the evidence, constantly reviewing your position. So you want to always examine where you are. Have we missed something out? Go back, look at it. Okay, that's actually going to take us somewhere else. That's what's important, yeah? Challenging, don't be afraid to challenge. I mentioned there about the covert cameras and stuff. We held that. And we have a challenge phase to an interview. You might have to challenge in your negotiation. Say, oh, actually, hang on. Is that really what you're saying?
Mm.
So you've got to be nice. You've got to negotiate your way. But there might come a time when you have to say, hang on a minute.
Yeah.
You know what your competitors are offering. And it might not be possible. That's just not possible.
Yeah. Dave the Detective, thank you so much for coming and joining us. It's been enlightening. It's been tough in a few areas because we know some of the real serious things that you've been involved in. But it's been really great to hear how the powerful interviewing that you've done and some of the techniques and how we can learn from that in our world. So thank you so much.
Okay. No, thank you.
You've been listening to The Procurement Show. Contact us by email, hello@theprocurementshow.com. Connect with us on LinkedIn, search for The Procurement Show, and visit us at theprocurementshow.com. You can also WhatsApp us on +44 7396 939933. The Procurement Show is brought to you by Positive Purchasing, transforming procurement with exceptional tools and advanced training. Produced in the UK by Fresh Air Studios. The Procurement Show is copyright Positive Purchasing, all rights reserved.
Meet Ruby.
Hello.
Your negotiation co-pilot powered by AI.
Oh, yes.
Ruby guides you and your team to plan your negotiation. And because it's built on the famous red sheet method, you can be certain of the best outcome.
Woohoo!
And if you need help, just ask Ruby.
I'll help you.
Or access the onboard learning.
Don't forget.
I haven't forgotten. I'm saving the best till last.
Woo.
Because Ruby can then do the negotiation. Using AI and our 20 years negotiation experience, Ruby is one of the best trained negotiators you will find. If you want to win, role play with Ruby. To find out more, just search Ruby Negotiation or visit positivepurchasing.com.